Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Discover how you can take charge of the all-new Corsa E on opel.ie.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
I'm in trouble with Donegal, the whole county today. So that's quite a good record for a Friday, getting in trouble with the whole county. This is about the Seesaw app, which when you ask it to speak to you in Irish, it uses Donegal Irish. And Pat Fitzpatrick, I'm going to blame him. He's from Cork. He said he wants a Cork Irish version of the Seesaw app because he can't understand it. Now, a Donegal accent, says this listener, and the Irish is beautiful. It's the most musical and is worth the work. Well, it certainly does sound lovely, and nobody is saying that it doesn't. But if you can't understand it, it's a bit tricky, isn't it? Someone finds it a bit offensive, the chat around Donegal Irish. Everyone in Donegal has to tune their ear into learning Leinster and Munster Irish too, which are all different. So the point there is you have to just get used to it. When I was at school in the Donegal Gaeltacht, our Gaeilge wasn't represented in school books at all. So I'm glad to hear things have changed. That's a minefield now. I'm just going to leave that. 51551 though, if you want to talk to us about it. It's time for our Friday gathering. I'm joined in the studio by People Before Profit TD for Dunleary, Richard Boyd Barrett. Archivist and broadcaster Katrina Crowe is here too. You're both very welcome. And I'm joined from Mayo by Fianna Fáil Senator for Mayo, Senator Lisa Chambers. So I want to start with the Mother and Baby Homes Commission report, which was huge news this week. And I know it's been a really difficult week for the people directly affected by that. And many people won't have had a chance to read and digest the whole report, even at this stage. Lisa Chambers, I'll start with you on this. How do you think that report was received overall?
I think it was received with a lot of, I think, heartbreak. You know, I suppose it's the next step in trying to bring some sort of closure for victims and survivors and their families. But I think overall it was good to see it finally published, to lay it all bare. I think a lot of it we knew, but quite frankly, I think that some of it was probably not known. I think that the figure of 9,000 babies having lost their lives in those homes, I think really, really struck people.
Do you know, Richard Boyd Barrett, if we bring you in, as time went on, as the week progressed and people had more time to read and digest it, I found that the responses to the report were getting more and more critical of it. And I'm thinking about Catherine Connolly and yourself there as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm quite disturbed by the report, and I think a lot of the survivors are. I mean, before the report was published, what survivors were saying to me, among many concerns they had, but one of the big ones was that their history, their narrative would be taken away from them, stolen from them, that had already happened, you know, with the lives they've led, and that it would be done again. And I have to say there's a big element of that in this report. And I said it in Leaders' Questions on Tuesday to Micheál Martin. I mean, the executive summary around the report tried to, downplay or it diminished the value of the survivor's testimony as actual evidence. It kept using this phrase, there's no evidence, even though we had the testimony of the women is evidence. I mean, in court, that's evidence. And yet they were saying it's not evidence. Well, and they were trying to disperse responsibility for these horrendous crimes that led to 9,000 infants losing their lives in shockingly disproportionate numbers in these mother and baby homes, and sort of dispersing responsibility as if it's nobody's really
just
nobody's
to
fault.
Come back to that evidence point, I'm thinking of the line that said there's no significant evidence that physical abuse took place in there. Is that what you're referring to there? Because we know in the testimonies there was evidence of physical abuse.
Absolutely. And also this sort of it wasn't really as bad as the industrial schools, as if we're in a sort of league table of abuse severity, when in fact you had testimonies that, you know, were really horrific. And I mean, when you think about 9,000 infants, and that's only a snapshot, because this commission report is only dealing with a fraction of the mother and baby infrastructure that was operating in this country. So there was almost certainly thousands and thousands of more infants lost their lives in disproportionate numbers, which is not really explained in it, where undoubtedly class and poverty played an absolutely huge factor in discrimination against particular groups. And all of that was sort of downplayed, and then responsibility for it was dispersed, essentially letting the church and the state off the hook for their responsibility for this, you know, really what was the sort of Catholic Taliban state that was operating, treating women and children in the most appalling way. So I find it disturbing.
Katrina, is the problem with the report or the government response to it?
The problem, I'm afraid, is with the report and the government response to it. But as Richard said, there are some very bizarre conclusions reached by the commissioners of the report. They say there's no evidence of forced adoption and then tell us but the women had no choice. What does that mean? There's plenty of evidence of forced adoption. No evidence of physical abuse. There's loads of stuff about punching and slapping and beating in the evidence from the survivors. Plus, what do you call putting a woman through childbirth without an anaesthetic while taunting her about her previous sins? That is physical and emotional abuse. People were not forced into the homes by church or state. That is to totally misunderstand the evidence in the report itself by the very good historians who wrote the contextual history that goes along with this. There are very useful things about this report, by the way. It's a considerable research achievement. Mm. What's wrong with it is its methodology, first of all. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, you had Noelle Brown on your programme on Wednesday morning. Noelle is a friend of mine. She's a playwright. She is a fantastically articulate advocate for survivors. She is one of only two people who managed to get her testimony out of the commission. For 5 years, they consistently refused to give people their own testimony. Nobody could understand why, and they did not deign to explain why. When she got it, she found that it was inaccurate in many serious respects. Not just that, it consisted of 220 questions, a template for interviews at the confidential committee, dealing, she said, largely with things like religious affiliation and social class, with little boxes sometimes containing the words that she actually said. Now, if anyone, nobody, by the way, that I know of, has managed to read this entire report since it was published. The politicians who got it before have had that opportunity. It's 3,000 pages long. I have to read the whole thing because I'm going to write a very long piece about it. It's going to take me 100 pages a day for a whole month to read it. So that's a caveat that we all have to mention. Anyway, what when you look at the actual report itself, what you expect to see are sections saying this witness from Castle Pollard said the following. No, it is paraphrased by the commission with short inserts of people's own words. To me, that is the most egregious breaking of any protocol that you should have.
Just to go back to Noelle and the conversation that we had with her here on the programme, it was quite extraordinary that she saw this transcript of her own evidence whereby there were typed questions there that she says she was never asked.
No, she was never asked. We had a long conversation this morning and she said there was a woman taking notes who was obviously ticking boxes in relation to these questions. Now, I can't emphasise, Claire, how important this is, because although there are many, many issues to take with the conclusions in this report, and also, if I may say, its lack of empathy. You know, there really isn't a stroke of empathy where they do say the women should not have been in the homes. But you compare this to Sean Ryan launching the report on industrial schools in 2009. He gave a press conference.
I was there, yeah.
And you remember it well. He explained the methodology of the report. He condemned the atrocious treatment of children in the institutions and he took questions. Where are the commissioners of the Mother and Baby Home report? Where are Yvonne Murphy, William Duncan and Mary Daly? They have not deigned to answer any questions. You sent an email to them from your show to ask them to respond to Noelle's allegations. They sent a one-line reply saying, we do not propose to respond to this. Now, that is the height of arrogance. It would be really wonderful if they could come out of wherever they are, hold a virtual press conference, of course, that's what they'll have to do, and answer the very many questions that survivors and their advocates and others have to ask them. Okay. I've never come across something like this before, where people just vanish.
Okay. We got in touch with the commission on that Wednesday morning. That was the response that we got. I'm sure that they would object to it being described as arrogant or would suggest that certainly wasn't their motivation. But I want to bring back in Senator Lisa Chambers on this now. I mean, it's very clear, Lisa, that people are upset with some of the conclusions in the report and the response to that report.
Yeah, I mean, I fully accept that. And I'm certainly not going to tell any survivor or family member that they should be accepting of this or happy about this. It's really, it's irrelevant what anybody's opinion is of this except for those directly affected by it. And I actually think that the suggestion there by Katrina that the Commission would do a press conference and take questions is entirely reasonable. And it's a very good suggestion, actually, because if we've learnt anything from this experience and this process is that honesty and transparency is what people are looking for, and just being straight up about things. So if there are questions there to be asked and answers to be provided, I see no reason why the Commission, the Commissioners could not make themselves available to answer those questions. And I'm sure that Minister O'Gorman might take that reasonable request on board and see what he can do to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And certainly I will pass that up the line as far as I can to make that request.
Because, well, if members of the Commission want to come on this show, we'd be happy to host them, and we would do a long question and answer session with survivors if that was an option for them, and we'd be delighted to host that here on the programme. There's another issue in there as well, a recommendation from the Commission that women who entered the mother and baby homes after 1973 shouldn't be part of the redress scheme. Now, I think the reason for that is because of the introduction of the unmarried mother's allowance, as it was called, in 1973. And there are very many people who are disputing that that should happen. What's your own view?
My own view is that that's the wrong decision. The redress scheme isn't just about providing financial support. It's about compensating people for the utter cruelty and demeaning way that they were treated by the state, by the church, by their communities. So they deserve that compensation. And I think that, again, we've had redress schemes previously for other issues, and there's always this red tape, bureaucracy, treating people, making them jump through hoops to get what we're saying they are entitled to. Let's do things differently this time. You know, let's have a very open redress scheme, bring people in and listen to survivors. The government are very clear. We want to be led by the survivors and the families and the victims of this. And it's about centering the approach on them. Mm-hmm. And the first step to that is the recommendations in that report, the redress scheme, the access to personal information. That needs to happen because, as the Taoiseach said, in what I consider to be a very heartfelt state apology, where he was clearly moved by what happened, but he said words are words. And the actions that flow from this will really be the test.
Richard Boyd-Barrett is shaking his head.
I'm sorry, but there was a constant refrain from which echoed some of what I consider offensive commentary in the report itself, was echoed by the Taoiseach in terms of, you know, it was society as a whole, which was very consciously, in my opinion, trying to displace responsibility away from the church and state authorities. And disperse it onto where, you know, because if everybody's to blame, nobody's really to blame. Nobody is held responsible. And that then you see things like the leak on the Sunday, accompanied by an interview with the Taoiseach. Very offensive and insulting to the survivors. The fact that the survivor journalists were given hard copies of the report on Wednesday morning, when the survivors didn't see them until later that day. In fact, to be honest,
and we know Minister Roderick O'Gorman condemned that leak and said that it would be investigated.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, will it be? We shall see. But I mean, survivors, it's a bit late, although it needs to change now, but survivors should have been at the centre of the entire process of the publication, of the speech. To be honest, the Taoiseach should have consulted with the survivors before he even made his apology to get their opinion about what he should say about the report.
Lisa Chambers, can I put that point to you as well? Because we heard so many times in the days leading up to that apology that the survivors didn't want that apology on Wednesday. They wanted some time to be able to read the report. It just came for many people far too quickly. And there are those now who would say that the government didn't listen to them.
And again, I'm not going to dispute the feelings and the views of survivors, because that's just not my, I'm not in a position to do that. What I will say is that I do think there's probably a, there isn't one unified view on that across all survivors. It would be one point I would make. And I think in relation to what Richard had said about trying to disperse that responsibility across all of society, I really don't think there was any intention on the part of the government or the Taoiseach to try and take away from the role of the state and the church. Let's be very clear about this. The book stops with the state. they had the responsibility for looking after the most vulnerable citizens, and they failed, and they failed miserably. And they are ultimately responsible. But yes, people's families, communities and the church played a significant role in compounding all of that. But ultimately, the absolute clear message from myself as the government representative and the government is the state are the key responsible entity in all of this. And they must stand up now and actually follow through on the report recommendations and provide that redress, provide that information to personal information, and do whatever we can to try and bring closure for people and not compound that hurt any further.
Catriona Crowe, what did you make of An Taoiseach's apology?
I thought it was all right as far as it went, but I mean, as everyone has said, you know, the whole business of dispersing responsibility onto society, there's certainly no doubt that families, particularly rural families, as anybody who reads John B. Keane or Tom Murphy or a whole plethora of people will know, had a huge interest in respectability, internalised misogyny towards their own daughters if they got pregnant. But where did those ideas come from in the first place? What you have actually going on, starting in the 19th century and continuing right through the 20th century, is the Catholic Church operating as a shadow state in this country. With the full blessing of the elected government, they're delivering health, education and so-called institutional care to millions of our citizens. As a shadow state, and the reason I'm concerned about this is because their archives are still their own property. Yep. And they should be opened up for everyone to see. It will give us lots of information about governance, finance, connections between church and state, all of those things. So far, very few of them are open for anyone to look at. The records relating to survivors are thankfully now in the possession of Tusla, although I'm not that encouraged by the fact that they're in the possession of Tusla. I would like to know that they're safe and well in a proper archival setting where their preservation can be assured and where access to them can
and
be granted.
And the Commission made the point that the problem is not with Tusla, it's with the law.
Well, that's all very well, but there are many survivors who have said they'd had bad experiences with Tusla trying to trace their... And I don't want to belittle or defame anybody. Everyone has different experiences with this. But there are better ways to do this. And can I appeal to our current Attorney General, the latest in a long line of Attorneys General since the year 2000, when the whole business of trying to solve the adoption and tracing problem began? Could you solve the problem instead of putting a brick wall in the way? If we have to have a referendum, this is serious. Enough for this. And if all the pietistic stuff we're hearing about the survivor is really important to put them first. They have said time and time again for decades, what they want is access to their own information. We are one of the only countries in the world that do not grant access as of right to people to their own birth certificates. It's an outrage. And, leisurely way this has been approached.
But how do
really
you balance the rights of the birth mothers, some of whom will not want to have that information?
The answer
revealed?
Is, I'm afraid, Claire, you don't. That is not what happens in other countries. When somebody reaches the age of 18, they are given their file and they are treated like adults and allowed to go about what they need to go about. That Supreme Court decision in 1998 was bizarre. And I have huge sympathy for birth mothers who have never told anyone their secrets. I got tons of phone calls from them when I discovered those foreign adoption files in 1996. But over the years, I'm absolutely adamant now, the right to any individual's identity has to trump the right to privacy of another person. And that's a harsh thing to say. And I understand
how
difficult it may
be. Well, it is because some of these women have already been greatly traumatised.
No, that look, and huge support needs to be there and empathy for the birth mothers without a shadow of a doubt. But you, I mean, the most basic thing anybody has is their identity. And even at the most elementary level of your medical history, I mean, you know, I know many stories of people who discover belatedly they have genetic conditions, sometimes fatal genetic conditions, which they might have known more about and would have got better treatments had they actually had access to their medical history. So this is, you know, there's just no question but people have the right to that. And to be honest, I mean, of course, we have to be sensitive and support the mothers. But to me, one of the bigger problems here is that shadow state and, if you like, the private control by religious organisations over our health system, over our education system and all of that history and archives and all that, this shadow state persists and it is a significant block to the right that survivors should have to their histories and identities. And that just should not be tolerated.
Okay, and the records that you refer to that should be released are the in possession of the religious orders, Katrina?
Yes,
their own records.
There are two things. And I know archives are incredibly boring for most people. I get it. And they're also dirty and dusty after 40 years of dealing with them. But the records of the survivors are the most important ones because they are the ones that matter to them. Mm-hmm. They need to get the information about their own identities and backgrounds and how they were treated when they were in these homes. But the administrative records of the congregations are hugely important because they tell us what the ideology was that they operated under. It tells about connections between them and the clergy and the state. It tells about their governance. It tells about their personnel. It tells about their finances. There's a whole lot of things we need to know about the religious orders, including the fact that they go back quite a long period in our country, including the fact that they did some good things in their time. A lot of girls in the 19th century would never have got an education if it weren't for some of the nuns here. But there are all sorts of divisions and riven things about it that we need to be able to have a look at. It just seems to me that if somebody had the guts in government to say, OK, we need to actually take these records over and make them part of the scholarly cohort of records that already exist about how this country was run. They played a gigantic part in it.
Okay.
And can I just say one more thing?
Yep.
Noel Brown is going to be on the Late Late Show tonight and everyone should watch her and hear what she says. She doesn't think she'll be able to go into the detail that I could this morning about what happened to her testimony. But I thought it was important that people should hear it.
Okay, and that's on tonight on RT1. Yes, Lisa Chambers, yeah.
Claire, just as a point of clarification, the Attorney General has confirmed to the Taoiseach that no referendum is required and that a bill will be published shortly on the information tracing legislation. So that's good news for survivors.
It is, because I know that David Kenny, the Professor of Law at Trinity, had written a piece for the Journal where he said, and he said he's very clear on this, that a referendum was not needed. So we're at the point where things are moving. And that's thanks for bringing that clarification to us. I want to talk, we're going to talk in more detail about COVID, but we have spent a lot of time, as we should do, on that issue. But the Leaving Cert, you were raising this yesterday, Richard Boyd Barrett in the Dáil. You want to see it scrapped?
Well, I don't want any
for this year.
I don't want any student forced into doing it. I think those who want to do it should be facilitated, but I don't think anybody should be forced. There is absolutely, given the situation with COVID, there is no certainty the Leaving Cert can be held, and there won't be certainty at the end of this month. In fact, there won't be certainty at the end of April. This, I mean, Tony Holland was asked at a leader's briefing recently, could he give certainty about restrictions being lifted by Patrick's Day? He said, "No, I can't. Of course I can't." We didn't know we were going to be in a massive surge, although some of us warned we might be in January because of government policy. But look at the situation we're in now. So these students are stressed to bits and the government need to give them certainty. And I think the only certainty they can give them is saying you will not be forced to do the Leaving Cert. We will facilitate those who do. And we have find an alternative method to get you into higher level education.
Lisa Chambers, we had your party colleague, Senator Timmy Dooley, on the programme yesterday, and he shares that view. He thinks that the time to make the decision is now.
Yeah, I would be of a slightly different view, and it's not. I'm not not sensitive to the anxiety, the stress among students across the board. My concern is more around the predicted grades that we had from last year. There were a lot of difficulties with that. A lot of students felt they lost out and didn't get the grades they would have gotten ordinarily. So I would agree with Richard's point that the Leaving Cert needs to be reviewed, and we definitely have to have that conversation about potentially having a whole new examination process. But we don't have that process right now. And my own concern is that the only way we know that we can assess students completely fairly is by an examination where you do predicted grades. The algorithm that's used takes into account previous grades in a school, teacher's own assessment. And I just think there's lots of difficulties with that. And I would just worry about students not being treated fairly across the board would be my concern.
Like, so it's like the special needs issue. There's been a whole year almost to work this out now.
I think in terms of working this out, it's not something that can happen that quickly. If we're going to completely replace the Leaving Cert, that's going to be a really long process involving teachers' unions, teachers themselves, students and the department. And we're just not there yet. So I think if we can hold the traditional Leaving Cert, it's the fairest way of assessing students in the absence of any other proper assessment method is my only concern. Mm-hmm. We've seen what happened last year. There were students, I had them on to me as well, that they missed out on courses that they had spent years studying for because they felt they didn't get the grades they wanted. The vast majority of students were happy, but my concern is that there were a number of students that felt they didn't.
I just wonder, though, is it wise for the minister from your own party, Norma Foley, to be adamant that the Leaving Cert is going to go ahead when surely you just can't be sure at this stage?
Well, what she has said is that she wants it to go ahead. They are meeting in the next number of weeks to see how that can happen. Maybe it doesn't happen in June. Maybe it gets pushed on a month or two and we just have to get those assessments corrected quicker so that the CAO applications can take place. Now, there's a suggestion that we could do predicted grades and the Leaving Cert have both options. But I think what we saw from last year is that there was a slightly inflated level of points awarded because of the way that the predicted grades were done. And that disenfranchised students from the previous year.
Yeah, I think people just want certainty, don't they? They just want certainty.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's on that point, I would fully agree. But I just think it's not as simple as saying, let's just do predicted grades and dispense with the Leaving Cert. I think it's too black and white.
You just can't force people who are stressed to pieces to do something that even the government can't actually deliver. Okay. To deliver.
Our time is up, but I want to thank Richard Boyd Barrett, Lisa Chambers and Katrina Crowe for joining us on the programme. That's all from us for today and this week. Thank you very much for listening.